둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button, of course, so you can keep up with the entire series that we put out. Three new interviews every single week, just like this one. A new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Makes it a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones as well. You can, of course, grab us at Spotify, at Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the show a rating, leave a review while you're at it. Those always help out quite a lot. Some great guests have dropped by lately, including Victoria Justice. Chloe Coleman was here. She's starring in My Spy, The Eternal City. Ashton Irwin from 5 Seconds of Summer. Sabrina Carpenter, Common, Pete Rock, Kali Cantrell to talk about Descendants, The Rise of Red. Mark Oliver Everett from the band Eels, 21 Pilots were here. Annabeth Gish to talk about Ride and Pretty Little Liars. Anthony Michael Hall of the Brat Pack and Kurtwood Smith of That 70s Show. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's a special rewind episode. In fact, we're going to rewind twice. Once to 2011, where I first met my hero, Chris Cornell, backstage at the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky, right here where I'm based. And then in 2015, backstage at the Ryman Auditorium in the Johnny Cash Room, while Johnny Cash Jr. waited for his turn to talk with Chris just outside the door. Crazy moment. But in fact, all of this felt like crazy moments to me. So much of what I do and what a lot of people in my work do, it really, you're just trying to impress your teenage self. I've said this before. I've said it many times. I'm happy to say it again. Chris Cornell is the artist who changed my life. It was hearing them in eighth grade when Super Unknown had just come out that led me to every single thing that I ended up doing in my career. And beyond that, they're just one of my favorite bands. I was such a huge fan. I got to know Chris over a pair of interviews. We had lots of mutual friends. And then, of course, him passing away was soul crushing. I still listen to Chris probably every single week. And to quote him, nobody sings like him anymore. The songs are just, they're still the greatest songs of all time, right? So today we're revisiting a pair of my interviews with Chris Cornell. Again, 2011, that's where we'll start. It was backstage at the Brown Hotel. He was on his Songbook tour, and we got to talk about Soundgarden. We got to talk about Temple of the Dog. We got to talk about his solo work, all that and more. So let's jump into it. Rewinding to 2011, it's Kyle Meredith with Chris Cornell.
Backstage, Chris Cornell, sir, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Well, you just, you came in, you've been on tour, the solo acoustic tour the whole time. How's it been going this time around?
It's been really good. It's been great, yeah. It's actually been going on a while now. One tour just kind of blends into another. So I did the first one, and then toured with Soundgarden in the summer for a while, and then kind of went straight back to this, went to Australia and then South America, and doing this acoustic tour, you know, kind of finishing up the U.S. The first one, it was 25 shows. That's actually not very many when in the U.S. You know, there's a lot of places to go.
Yeah, well, I guess you've been used to, especially with the Soundgarden days. I mean, you guys would do, what, 70 dates?
Yeah, like per record, we could do that many in the U.S. alone, easy, yeah.
That's got to be nuts. I mean, that's a long time. And, of course, you've been conditioned. You've been at this a little while now, but...
It seemed like a really long time then. Now it's just sort of, it's my life, kind of, you know.
You're coming up on a big birthday here in a few years.
Which one?
You're coming up on the 50th birthday.
Yeah, that's far away, though, I think.
Yeah. It could be far away. But as you get into this, I mean, rock and roll has proved itself now, definitely. But being a guy who's in the 40s, you're going to hit 50s, and you're still the big rock guy. I mean, how do you see that position?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's easier to see from a distance. Easier if you're looking at somebody else, and you have a sort of place in your mind where you can put everything. And for me, I have never been very good at including myself in that perspective. So I don't really bother trying.
So age is never a factor?
No, it doesn't really. It doesn't make sense to me. I participate without really making much of an attempt at figuring out how I fit. Because it's really difficult to have a perspective on it. And, you know, there's lots of different examples of how other people feel about individuals in music and what their contributions mean. And time is kind of the yardstick that I go by. So the one conviction I have is that I'm lucky, and you know, the bands that I've worked with over the years, we're all lucky because our music has seemed to last this far, and that's good. Other than that, you know, as to what it really means, or rock music in general, or pop culture, or you know, any kind of culture, I think the meaning changes depending on when you're asking the questions.
It's interesting that you said you talk about the contributions and what it means to rock. It's been a debate with me and my friends about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Some people are so against it, they just think it's unneeded. You guys seem like it's going to be, you know, one day you're going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, Soundgarden has contributed to that. Do you have an opinion?
Well, I don't know. The people that I know in music that get excited about it are almost always also critical of it in some way or another, and it gets a little bit confusing. For me, it's kind of simple in that it seems like something that has normally been associated with sports, and there's a lot of musicians that are sports fans, and they can kind of relate to it that way. I don't really relate to it that way, but also I think if it were a process that were more kind of open, as opposed to a panel or a jury that decides who gets included, then maybe I would be less critical of it. But to me, that just rock music and a panel or jury deciding things about it and what it means and what that doesn't make any sense. So I've never really thought much of it.
It's not very rock and roll, actually, when you put it that way, is it?
It's not very rock and roll at all. But then you have these moments like the Tom Hanks produced Rock and Roll Hall of Fame HBO special, which was great. And that makes somebody like me feel happy that it's there, because then an event like that can take place. And you can see all these people coming up and performing music. And for whatever reason, there seem to be a lot of really amazing performances. And that's something I can get behind, because it's something that's almost more fan-driven and good for fans to be able to see, and it's more celebratory. And one of the complaints that everybody I know has had from the beginning of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is that the ceremonies are sort of cheaply done and unceremonious, I've never seen one that was compelling or exciting or amazing or seemed celebratory or, you know, had anything to do with the vitality that these different musicians came from or created. But you know, one person took great pains to explain to me that how it was all for the fans, and that I should be excited about it because my fans will be happy to see me inducted. And that you can't argue with. If that's what, if it makes fans happy, then I think it's a good thing.
And we'll be right back right after this.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Chris Cornell.
You're, of course, I mean, everybody always likes to point out that iconic voice that you've been able to hold on to all these years. And it is. It's sounding, I think, more amazing than maybe ever. How are you keeping it? Do you have to keep it in shape, or is this just something you've been kind of blessed with?
There's, I guess, certain things you learn over time that are probably different for everybody. Like things you can do and not do, and timing, you know, and when you can do and not do those things, and how far can you really push it, and in what way. And then all of those rules kind of change as you get older, because your vocal cords, which are, it's really like a fleshy disc with a slit down the middle that's about the size of a quarter, and they change as you get older, and so you have to kind of relearn. It's a strange thing, and then through that you sort of have to forget everything, because really it's just an instrument that should be something that is kind of available to be used as an instrument to convey whatever you want to emotionally. And that's impossible to do if you're worried about what it can do in terms of scales and notes and timbre and whatever else. So the probably the best and most important thing I learned is not to worry about it too much.
So has there ever been that spot where you've thought back on a few of your older songs, Nothing to Say, Birth Ritual, and you went, man, I wish I hadn't written that so high. I've got to go out and do that.
You know, there's a couple songs that I lobbied to never have released just because I sang them so high because it sounded silly to me. And I think there was a period in my career where I did that just because there didn't seem to be a ceiling. You know, I just kept going higher and higher and higher. And at some point it reached a level where it just didn't sound like anything other than, you know, helium. It just seemed silly. And at that point, I started backing off that. So I think through Soundgarden's last two records and past that, I started to kind of calm down on the range. And then I noticed after doing that for like 6 or 8 years or something that I couldn't sing those songs as easily. But then getting back into singing some of the songs with a higher range, I got all of that range back. It was sort of how I got it in the first place, was just doing it.
Right.
I wasn't born with a high range. I mean, it's a little out of what would naturally be there for me, but I figured out how to do it. But I don't know that it's important. I think, in a sense, it's something that I became known for accidentally. It wasn't something that I wanted to be known for. And to me, it's what's always been the most important thing is it interesting in whatever range it's in? And I think the other problem that it creates having the ability to have that range is when it came to songwriting, and still even now, I spend a little more time focusing on what register I'm singing in now, but I used to never even think about it. I just had a melody idea for the song, and whatever key the song was in and started out in would just stay that way, and then if it was hard to sing, it was hard to sing. And I think about that more now, mainly because I think the song is the most important thing. And being able to kind of connect with it emotionally is the most important thing in the song. And to just grab a melody in any register and sing it, you're sort of a little bit at the mercy of whatever the key of the song started in.
It's interesting, of course, to hear you go back and talk about all these different stages of your career. Are you able to look back on that as a yearbook? I mean, when you look at this stuff, when you're singing certain songs, is that still certain points of your life that you keep having to relive and relive and relive?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a time machine, because I don't think of it as years gone by. Like if I'm singing a song like Soundgarden, just spent a lot of time kind of relearning a large part of our catalog. So we were going back and listening to old recordings, and I was physically trying to play and sing the songs at the same time, and some of the guitar parts are really hard to sing over, you know, and suddenly it was just like, you know, I remembered every little thought and emotion I had about it the first time it was written and the first time I heard it and tried to sing and play it. It's all like right there. It's like it happened the day before, you know. And the good thing about that is that I have this sort of clear vision of what those thoughts and feelings and obstacles were, and I can kind of continue to solve the puzzles and the problems that came along with all of that. You know, always trying to evolve in terms of where the song goes in the context of a live performance.
So is Soundgarden now your focus for 2012?
Probably for a lot of it, yeah. We're trying to finish up an album, and then, you know, we'll be touring to support it. The first thing that happens in my life in 2012 is touring with Soundgarden in Australia, so.
It's nice to get down there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just there, but I can't wait to go back. Play more shows with Soundgarden, because, you know, for some reason, I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's because we were so eclectic. I still feel like there's some better version of me as the singer and guitar player, you know, that my contribution in that band, there's still some sort of better version of that as a live musician and performer. Not so much performer in that, you know, I can think of something else to do as a performer, but just in terms of the music and performing it and where it can go. I feel like there's something else I can bring to it that's better than I ever have. And the only way to do that is to actually get out there and really do it and find that, whatever it is.
Yeah, I guess I'd read in an interview, made the Rolling Stone interview, where you guys were saying, like, we're picking up right where we left off, too. So, you know, as far as what people are looking forward to, you know, what's the record going to sound like, that whole thing? I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, the problem is that when you say something like that, it can lead anybody to believe what you're saying is it will sound like we sounded on our last album. But the thing is, we never really did that from one album to the next, even if two albums came out in 1 year. So when I think of what the next logical step would be, or picking up where we left off, that type of perspective, it includes some type of musical evolution that it would have included anyway. And the only thing that's not completely in sync with it could have been a 2-year break or a 15-year break is just that I think, you know, we all bring considerable amount of experience back into the studio and into songwriting and arranging. And I think there's less less sort of self-conscious perspective, because we were a different band even in 1996. You know, we were a band that sort of existed within a world of other bands, and that was kind of considered to be part of a genre, in a sense, that was almost more geographically definable than musically definable. But and there was also this strong current sort of commercial rock marketplace that our record label considered us to be competitive players in. And now we're at a different place where we're sort of in a genre of one, and, you know, we don't have competitors. We just are who we are and have been accepted as that. And that kind of, that changes a lot. I don't know that it necessarily adds a lot more confidence, but there's less distraction.
It's got to be nice, actually, to see all the fans. I mean, it's not even the fans. I think the critics are going crazy, like, wow, it's actually going to happen. This is happening.
Yeah, they're just sitting there like they can't wait to listen to it and then try to sort of take it apart and put it back together and then decide what it's going to mean 10 years from now. Now.
Yeah, right. and you're to a point in your career now, too, where you kind of, I don't know, it seems like you would get to have your cake and eat it, too. You can be a solo artist, you can be in a band, and you don't have to ever choose. I mean, you go back and forth.
Well, yeah, I mean, that started out that way, in a sense. I started playing guitar and bass right around the time Soundgarden formed. And up till then, I was a drummer, and I sang, but I had never actually sang in a band. I would just sing backups and stuff. And pretty much right away, songwriting became a focus. And it was never about actually being able to play an instrument well. It was about being able to use it to create music. And I started doing that a lot with Soundgarden, and then simultaneously just on my own for fun. And that never stopped, so that was always there. So, you know, I did a few different things outside of Soundgarden, but I remember when Temple of the Dog came out, I had different people telling me, wow, I'm really surprised that you could sing like that or write songs like that. And I always took it negatively, and I also always took it like, you know, I didn't understand why Why would they not think that I was capable of something different than they'd already heard? And then a few years went by and I started to sort of understand it. Like, why would they? If they haven't heard it, then maybe they wouldn't know. But to me, I was always, everyone in my band always felt that I was capable of doing anything I wanted. And I was always encouraged by everyone in my band, always. But it just was—it was something that was more personal and not something until Temple of the Dog, I suppose, that ever had a venue.
Do you remember your first solo show?
Well, I did a show with Matt Cameron and Scott Sundquist, who was the drummer in Soundgarden between me and Matt, which was about a year. And it was an acoustic show, and I played a 12-string, and I think Matt played guitar and I'm pretty sure, and Scott played percussion, and it was like an hour long or something acoustic show. I don't know why I played 12-string. It was really hard to play, and I think that in my mind was sort of what I thought of as my first solo show. And it got one write-up in like a local fanzine in Seattle, and they gave it a positive review, which I didn't agree with it because I thought that I was awful. And then I didn't do it again. And then the first solo show for Euphoria Morning, for my first solo album, I remember really well. It was in Boston, and I wasn't planning on coming out and playing really anything except for music from that album. You know, I wasn't doing what I do now. You know,
starting all over.
Yeah, completely. And it was a sold out show, and there was like one guy who was seated and kind of rowdy near the front, and you know, I could hear him kind of yelling, being rowdy, and he was clearly someone that was a hard rock fan and a Soundgarden fan. Mm-hmm. And that was the guy I was worried about. You know, I just thought, everyone else will, even if they don't like it, they'll tolerate it, but this seems like a guy that's just going to have to be heard, you know? And we came out, and he had this look of confusion for it may have been a whole song, you know, it may have been like somewhere halfway between the second song. It might have been faster, though. A look of confusion, I think, and then the song ended, and somehow or another, he connected to it, and then he seemed so overjoyed that he could, you know, that even though it was different, he could get it. Yeah. And he stood up and just started, like, pumping his fist in the air and yelling, fuck yeah, all right, yeah, right on, you know, that kind of thing. And that was the last time I really worried about it. Because I thought, like, you know, this is going to be, in anything that I do outside of a band that had such a strong identity, some people are going to not like it as much. And other people are going to like what I do that didn't actually like that. And that's actually happened a lot. And because I've experimented with so many different things, like the album Scream has, there's fans of that album that aren't fans of anything else I've ever done, really.
Such a different record.
Yeah. And so it's, I'd sort of accepted that pretty early. Also, after Temple of the Dog, I had such a great experience with it, and it was such an eye-opening experience about how amazingly rewarding a collaboration like that could be, a quick one where there's no goal other than just enjoying playing music with people that you haven't played music with, and see what comes of it, you know. And in that case, there was no goal for anyone. There was no goal for the record company. They were just trying to just get through it and move on. A&M Records put out that album as a favor to me. They didn't really put anything behind it. They just wanted to get it out of the way. Until I heard it, then it was different. Then, but it taught me to be open to collaborations that would make sense and could be exciting, and that's why Audioslave happened for me. Yeah. For my part, I felt like, well, you know, it just seemed to me in my mind, sort of mulling over what the possibilities could be, that it would be stupid to not at least get in a room with those guys and see what happens. And then I was pretty confident that something would come of it right away. And it did, like, I don't know if it was 40 minutes or something, you know. We started playing music. I think we wrote a whole song and maybe started another one that could easily have been finished. And that was it. I just knew that we could be great and we would make great records.
Next stage of your life right there. I'll close my Chris Cornell wish list. Reissues, eventually. A DVD. Where's the you were on PJ20. Where's the SG30? Hopefully.
I don't know. I'm not that sure that that's important to me.
Well,
you know, I don't know. I watch not a lot of them. I watch some music documentaries, and some are really good. The two that I've seen that Scorsese did, I love, and they're very, very different than each other in terms of style. I felt like the Pearl Jam documentary was really great. You know, but it's also done by somebody that has experience in that from a teenager. But then there's like that series Behind the Music where it just seemed formulaic. And I guess what I don't want is a documentary to come out that can be seen and then anybody can feel like they've taken away a clear image or perspective of what Soundgarden is about and what we experienced, because I don't think that's possible. And I don't want to limit any individual's imagination to be sort of erased and rewritten by this film that is difficult to really, in that medium, convey what it felt like or maybe what it really was. And we're so eclectic musically, I almost would prefer that a large part of it remain a mystery or have at least not be demystified incorrectly, which I feel probably is what would happen with the film. It's just too literal. It's too... I probably mistakenly tried to keep film cameras away from Soundgarden all the years that we were playing live. And the main reason why is because I didn't want to ever see it, because it would replace my memory of the experience, which was always, to me, pretty crazy and ethereal and transcendent. And most of my memories of those shows are like memories you'd have of when you had a high fever or something. Mm-hmm. And I probably was an idiot to always try to kind of enforce that, because it would be nice to have a lot of that footage now, and that would probably help create some type of a documentary that, in the absence of, could make it impossible. I don't know.
Well, rock and roll has definitely lost the air of mystery, but you guys have kept that one, and it's been really nice. Chris Cornell, thank you so much.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle and Meredith rewinding with Chris Cornell. The second time that we got to do an interview was in 2015. As I mentioned, it was in Nashville. He was on his Higher Truth tour. We were in the Johnny Cash room of the Ryman, and it was just such, like, everything was loose and fun, and I just remember how easy it was, our conversation, joking from the very beginning. And, you know, I wish we'd had that third one, of course. I wish that he were still here, even if we never had the third one. I would much rather him be here than us have the third one, but God, I would love to have had a third conversation with him just to dive further into the way he worked and the way he wrote and how he wrote all these amazing songs. With that, let's do this. Part two of Kyle Meredith Rewind with Chris Cornell.
It's a nice, comfortable talking situation.
Yeah. I didn't have to move.
Usually the proximity is a bit closer, but it's like, all right, yeah, it's fine. It's backstage.
Yeah, but you can be in my shot, too. Like, I can see your profile.
Oh, I'm the camera hog. I'm the interview hog. Let's be honest, this interview's about me. It's not about...
Isn't it always?
We had a long discussion about that beforehand, and no, it's not.
You did?
Yeah.
With who?
With him.
Uh-huh. You guys talked about you. See what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it supports my third.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, that's BS. That doesn't hold water, what I just said, but...
Chris Cornell, back with a new record called Higher Truth, and it's a fantastic record.
Oh, thank you.
I think you're getting a lot of applause and accolades from this one.
Yeah, it seems very well received.
Yeah.
Most importantly by fans, and I kind of felt confident about, you know, the most of the way through. You know, I felt like it was kind of born from the songbook touring, you know, the solo acoustic touring, and wanting to feel like that became such a special thing for me, and being able to do all the other things I do, especially Soundgarden, and then be able to bifurcate the time between the two, where it's two really completely opposite things, has been really a blessing. And it's you know, there's no confusion for me creatively, nor for my fans. So I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make the songbook touring like a living thing, as opposed to always a look back, and wrote this album really in support of that.
That nostalgia, I know that can be tricky, especially for an artist who's kind of so associated with an era, you know, for better or worse. Yeah. I know that's a tricky thing for the longevity of a career, that you have to, I guess you have to consciously ignore that and you have to try to, you know, get past that.
I think there's a healthy way to do it. And then there's the sort of bully way to do it, which is you write a new album and then you go out and you tour and you refuse to play anything but that.
Oh, right.
And I think, for me anyway, my experience is that doing both is great, you know. I don't, or at least I haven't up to now, believed in the idea that when people buy a ticket to see you perform, that you not give them at least a little of something that you know that they're going to want.
Right.
And I know in the context of these solo acoustic tours, because they're screaming it at me, you know, I can hear them. there are no amps to like drown it out.
I'm sure it only gets comical if they start yelling Ty Cobb or something
like
that.
Well, yeah, that. I mean, that happens, you know, every night. You know, yeah. They're yelling a song that's not going to happen. You know,
right.
It's ridiculous to yell for, but I think that it's in the spirit of something good. And regardless of what I do, even during my first songbook tours where I was playing songs from Scream, very supportive of everything that I played, you know, it didn't matter. And on this tour, definitely, you know, supportive of the new material and happy to hear other material. So it's, you know, I feel like there's a good balance that I strike. And there's no and there's no predicting, you know. It's you're sort of constantly infusing a tour with new material, and you're sort of opening up the ears to it. It is a living, breathing thing, and that living, breathing thing can have a history. That's
right.
Fine. I'm lucky that I have it, you know. So
why aren't you doing a dual thing too right now? Because Euphoria Mornings got the re-release.
Uh-huh.
That hasn't happened yet, I don't think.
It did happen.
Week,
2 weeks ago.
How on hand were you for that? Like, was this a thing where you had to listen to Euphoria Morning over again? And did that have any influence, per se, like having to concentrate on that era of your life as we're talking about nostalgia?
No, the only thing it did, you know, for me was I think there was an essence of convenience to it, where the record company looked at it as, okay, we have this in our catalog, mm-hmm. and Chris is putting out a new solo album, and this is his first one, and people love it, and so we'll press it to vinyl because we never did before.
Just anything they can do. Yeah.
And I get it. You know, it's an investment they made 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
so it's on those books from 15 years ago. Why not? You know, and people, it's actually the one thing people will buy music for is to buy it on vinyl.
I'm guilty of it. I've went looking for it already. So.
Yeah. So I understand, and it also helped me because it's sort of you know, come back into discussions, particularly in chat rooms and you know, and viral stuff, which I've seen,
mm-hmm.
and it also gave me the opportunity to kind of adjust a couple things that I had wanted to for years. But I got to see, kind of simultaneously with the reception of Higher Truth, I got to see a lot of people talking about how important that album was for them.
Yeah.
And I think that all of that kind of positive energy is sort of elevated everything. And so, you know, I was happy with it. I think it was a good thing for them to do.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of Higher Truth, you know, I've heard you talk about really wanting to make this a storytelling album.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also heard you say, and I couldn't figure out if you were being sarcastic or not, that like half the record's about your wife.
I think that half of all my records.
Well, I looked
about
at that.
My wife. At least, you know, everyone that if I look back and kind of, it's a good 2 to 4 songs per, but a solo album, she's gonna have half. And I think that my kids make it in there too, in the way that I think it's just sort of the natural course of songwriting when, you know, your life really outside of your career is your family all the time. It's gonna be what you're thinking about.
You're bringing your family into your life more and more. I mean, I saw the video of you and your daughter up there. Are both your kids like wanting to be musicians? Are they on their way to being musicians?
Both of them definitely dabble in different aspects of being musicians and being interested in music, and appear to have sort of talent in a lot of different areas. Where it's almost kind of like, well, what, you know, whatever you decide you want to do, you can do. And you know, my feeling is support them more in those areas where they want to do something.
Have you turned into the old guy who's like, damn kids and your damn music?
No.
Whatever they're listening to, you know?
You know, no. I recently watched this news report on CNN about parents and their teenagers with the internet and handheld devices, and different ways of communicating through the internet and social media and that kind of stuff. And what was weird is a lot of these parents were younger than me, and a lot of them had no knowledge of what their kids do and what music they listen to and what their social media is. And I felt like, well, I'm actually sort of all over that. And I'm all over what they do, and I'm all over what they listen to, and we're all over sort of how they interact and what they say. And I feel like I'm kind of in step with them. And I haven't really pointed them in any direction in terms of what I think they should appreciate artistically, because I think that's a big mistake.
Sure, that's because they rebel against that. That's what
you're going to get the opposite.
Like, mine's still young enough. Mine's 8, so he's like, you know, he's okay with me.
Yeah.
Kind of. And I just kind of, you know, nudge it in there a little bit, you know.
The only thing I ever did was when I heard, now I don't remember what it was, Pandora or Spotify or something. My son was listening to what sounded like AC/DC songs from the other room, and I thought, I was listening to AC/DC. He chose that, and I thought, that's great. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's awful. And I went and I looked, and it wasn't, because they didn't license it.
Yeah.
So it was like LA Guns or something. It was some LA rock band doing their whole catalog. And so I had an iPod full of, you know, with thousands of songs, and I just gave it to him. I said,
You gotta
listen to the right stuff. But I think you know, they exposed me to things that I otherwise would not.
Yeah.
It wouldn't come across my plate. It just wouldn't. And so I think there's an exchange that happens. And I think that for me, at least, being a musician, I can connect to almost anything. But I'm still gonna have that.
Sure.
I think I have that in the context of analog music versus digital music, and performing musicians versus people performing to track and sort of ghosting their own performance on stage and all that kind of stuff. I don't get it. That doesn't draw me in. If I don't hear sort of the humanity to a performance on an album, it just doesn't draw me in.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a decision that I've made as much as it is just it's something that happens or doesn't. So I have that. You know, I have that kind of nostalgic desire to want to hear analog recorded music and live performances in a studio where you feel it from beginning to end as one performance, instead of something that's been edited in a computer after the fact.
It's a lost
which,
art.
By the way, I can hear that screams at me, those edits and how they're edited. And
you can hear that, you know.
Yeah.
Some of us now. But I try not to get too hard on that either, because, like, what was I listening to at that time that was so out of touch with, you know, a purist before me or something like that?
Sure.
Like, so, I'm the same way. I try not to put them down too much. I just don't listen to it myself.
Well, it's not something that's attracted me, and some, like, I remember really liking industrial music as in my late teens and early 20s, and there was something about it. It was a new kind of visceral music to me, and the content was very aggressive and kind of scary, and it was exciting. And I still think some of that music can be really exciting, and I still think that a lot of electronic music can be exciting, mm-hmm. but it's not going to beat something that I get an emotional connection with, and I'm not going to get that without sort of just hearing what feels like a person in a room or people in a room.
Sure. And I was about to say, my only argument was, you put a really great vocalist on it, you know, who's really given her heart, his heart, whatever it is, and skirt that in on the electronics. Like, you can have some soul in there.
I think that that's missing. I think that people swallow the whole pill instead of just biting a piece of it off. When I was making the album with Timbaland, I was in the studio, and they were going through a hard drive of a bunch of stuff that he had done that was just catalog stuff that had never been released. And there were songs that he was singing on, and they hadn't touched his vocals or edited it at all, you know. So there, it was just really raw. And I thought that was some of the coolest sounding stuff I'd ever heard him do. And I was telling them,
use that.
That is what you got to put out. And they're looking at me like I'm nuts. Because they're very much into a world of electronic post, you know, kind of has to do a certain thing, and I understand it, but it's a different world in some ways. I also think, though, that there's always scenes of purists, always. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can find that. Whatever you really want is out there.
You going to be on the campaign trail this time? I've been interested in that, to kind of see if you're going to be doing that. You did, you know, with Obama the last couple times, and I thought...
Yeah, you know, there was this... It depends. It depends on what it feels like to me. I felt like with Obama, there was a certain amount of fear in regard to, like, what would happen if he didn't win. You know, it felt almost like there's a damage control scenario there, and I think I'm sort of in a lot of ways that's how my thinking works when it comes to politics and when it comes to elections. It's like, okay, who's going to get nominated? And then, you know, what is the sort of the lesser of two evils in a way? And
I'm
I think
sure
with Obama,
it was very
clear. Mm-hmm. There was no confusion in regard to that. And, you know, we'll see how things play out now. But this is not something, there's nobody that's inspiring me, really.
It's pretty wacky out there.
Yeah. I also, in sort of paying attention in the last 8 years and really focusing on how events have taken place, I feel like it's going to take a lot more than any particular administration to make any real change. And I'm not sure, you know, other than barring some sort of breakdown in how this country is run, which is probably going to have to be a financial one, that you're going to see any real effective change. I think it's this constant sort of push-me-pull-you scenario that just keeps living on, and we keep sort of scotch-taping everything together, and at some point it isn't going to work.
I just think it's people not are lazy.
That's I think they are, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the unfortunate thing. I really, really do love Higher Truth. I know we didn't get to talk about it as much as I wanted to, but it's a beautiful record. You've really exceeded past...
Thank you.
...all the things, so thank you.
Thank you very much. I put a lot into it. It took 2.5 years or so to write, maybe a little more.
You can tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a lot in between then, but I think that really helped. I think that being able to take a couple months away from it while I'd be on tour with Soundgarden or touring for myself or whatever I was doing would allow me to come back with fresh ears. And it was something where I had to kind of reinvent myself as a songwriter in a lot of ways to make the whole thing work.
Well, we really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And there it is, Chris Cornell, 2015 and 2011. My eternal thanks to Chris, but of course, my thanks to you as well for checking out the episode. Before you get out, hit that subscribe button so you can get all the interviews just like this and that we put out every single week. A new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can grab us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. After that, head over to WFPK.org. where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You get 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. In fact, one of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Tom Waits and the Rolling Stones, Sierra Farrell, Melissa Etheridge, R.E.M., Everclear, Mike Doty, Joan Jett, Our Lady Peace, The Cure, David Bowie, and my interview with Ani DeFranco, who talked about her latest record, Unprecedented Stuff. That's just an example of what you can hear every weeknight when you tune in at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now, save 50% on the new Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed. Limited time. Exclusively at a Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.